Hello, and welcome to the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, brought to you by Left.MN, the Minnesota website that leans left. I'm Aaron Clems, and I'm here this week with Tony Petrangelo. And on today's show, we'll break down the news of the week, we'll talk about fundraising numbers that came out this week, and we'll ask Dr. Maureen Hackett if a wolf season is right for Minnesota. But first, the weekly wrap. Every week, Tony pans through tons of gravel at the bottom of the news stream and picks out the golden news nuggets that other less observant people miss. So what did you find this week, Tony?
I love that intro. That's so poetic.
I worked hard on that one.
Yeah, I could tell. It rings of hard work. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on this week. Kurt Bills, I guess this wasn't necessarily a nugget that people missed, but he released a campaign ad that some people thought was similar to somebody else's.
Is Kurt Bills a progressive Democrat? Is that what I hear?
Well, he likes to compare himself to a famous one.
Which one?
Well, we all see bumper stickers with his name on it, and
yeah, so this is Paul Wellstone. Paul Wellstone we're talking about. So
yeah, who had a famous ad from his campaign.
Yeah, it was called Fast Paced Paul, and you see Paul Wellstone popping up in all these different places and, you know, introducing his, you know, basically it was kind of an introduction ad, and it was a pretty low budget ad. And Kurt Bills is drawing a lot of parallels between his campaign and Paul Wellstone's campaign.
Because they both run on a shoestring budget, I guess, and is there any other similarities?
So they don't have any money, they're running against a popular incumbent, and they face long odds. Is that about the extent of it?
Yeah.
And otherwise, I think it was David Wellstone, or one of Paul Wellstone's sons, that said that beside that, there's basically nothing similar between Kurt Bills and his father.
Well, and Paul Wellstone never made a Twilight Zone-esque campaign ad either.
That's true. He didn't enter a 10-minute movie contest with really bad makeup and special effects. So we got Kurt Bills. How much? We'll talk about this in the next segment, but does Kurt Bills have a lot of money?
Well, no. Well, according to the most recent reports I got released, he has a little over $5,000 in the bank. $5,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, so to qualify that a bit, that same day that that deadline was, he went to Washington, had a big fundraiser with the younger and elder Pauls, Rand and Ron.
Rand and Ron.
Yes. So he probably got some coin out of that. But yeah, he doesn't have a whole lot of money in the bank, and he's running against someone who's got, as I pointed out, according to the recent documents, 900 times more money in the bank than he does, Amy Klobuchar.
Well, in the case of, if you're looking for similarities, that whole facing long, incredible odds, well, Kurt Bills has got that part. He's got a corner on that market, but beside that, I don't think he has much in common with Paul Wellstone. So CD8, we were talking a couple weeks ago to Aaron Brown from MinnesotaBrown.com. He brought us up to speed about the CD8 race, and a bunch of stuff happened this week. So he had two endorsements. So who endorsed who?
Yeah, the big dog was out. Bill Clinton.
The big dog.
Endorsed
Terrell Clark.
Yes.
You might recall that he also endorsed Terrell Clark last time around when she was running against Michelle Bachmann and spoke on her behalf in the last couple of weeks of the campaign, I think.
He's on his Hillary Clinton campaign or 2008 campaign payback tour right now, where he's going around and endorsing people who endorsed Hillary in 2008.
Well, it's nice of him. I mean,
that's what you do in politics.
Payback's nice. And certainly Terrell Clark was a full-throated supporter of Hillary Clinton, so that's a chance to give her something back. So Rick Nolan, the DFL-endorsed candidate, had to come up with his own endorsement, and he got...
Well, he got, I guess Minnesota's big dog, which would be Mark Dayton.
Well, Mark Dayton's got a couple of dogs.
Well, I guess, yeah.
He's got two. He's got the first and second dog. Then Emily's List, a group that has supported Terrell Clark, sent in a bunch of mailers that caused some controversy around issues around abortion. So that attracted a lot of attention in the last couple of days of the week as well.
The mailers were sent out specifically attacking Rick Nolan, but not at all mentioning the other candidate in the race who we haven't mentioned either, Jeff Anderson.
Yeah, Jeff Anderson. Nobody endorsed Jeff Anderson and nobody attacked Jeff Anderson.
Which tells you all you need to know about the state of Jeff Anderson's campaign.
Well, we'll see, but it's certainly been kind of a two-person race in the media this week between Nolan and Clark, and it's certainly that way in the money race as well.
And speaking of money, it appears that some Republican legislative candidates in the state have been doing some less than ethical fundraising techniques in order to get public subsidy money.
Yeah, it's on the Minnesota Progressive Project. They published an email from SD6 Republican Brandon Anderson. Brandon Peterson. I'm sorry. Is that right?
Yeah, Brandon Peterson.
And he's going up against Senator Dave Tomasoni. And he offered to reimburse people $50 if they would give him $50. And so if you don't know about this, in Minnesota we have a partial public financing system where you have to get a certain number of individual contributions by a certain date in order to qualify for some state money. And the idea here is if you show that you have a pretty broad base of individual contribution support, you deserve to get some kind of public subsidy so that you can actually do better campaigning. And it's the idea is to get people get people enthusiastic about actually going out and engaging individual people about their campaign rather than relying on big PAC money checks and stuff like that.
Well, and so that people who aren't independently wealthy can run. And the other side of it, too, is if you have a candidate who's spending significantly more than you, then the system will, you know, reimburse you to some degree to compete with that.
Right. And so this game that they're playing where they're offering to give money back to people who give individual contributions is a way of circumventing that system.
And his name is Brandon Anderson. I don't know why I had it in my head. His name was Brandon Peterson.
There is a Brandon Peterson, okay, actually, who also serves in the legislature, I believe. So we actually used to do this legitimately. We used to have the campaign contribution refund program where if you gave $50, you'd actually get that back from the state. The idea being, once again, to get people to get out there and actually engage individuals and small donors in their campaigns. Mm-hmm. And so this email basically came right out and said, I'm planning on circumventing the system. I will give you your money back if you give it to me, and then I'll get the money back from the state. So basically he said,
give me $50 and I'll give you $50 back.
He was
and if you wonder how he makes money on that, volume.
Well, he also makes money on that by he's basically loaning himself money from the state
in the
future.
Enough of those transactions, the volume of those transactions creates the subsidy money.
That's right.
So that's the only way that scam works is you just have a bunch of one-for-one transactions that inflates your fundraising total.
Yeah. And the word is that that's been a campaign finance board complaint has been filed on that case. And so we might hear more about that later on. There were also a couple other Republican candidates who apparently expressed interest. I wasn't really clear about that in the post. But a couple other folks seem to be interested in the same kind of technique. But the public financing deadline, I think that came and gone this week.
Yes,
right?
That was the deadline for the reports. Was I believe the same deadline as for the public financing.
Yep. Then we have next week actually coming up. There was a news item that came out at the end of this week on Thursday, and next Thursday at 8:30 a.m. Mike Perry, the Commodore Perry. He will grandstand on the backs of state workers when he and the Draz convene the Subcommittee on Employee Relations to consider, quote-unquote, the contracts that AFSCME and MAPE just recently approved. These exorbitant contracts, by the way, include 2% raises.
2%?
2%.
And oh, my gosh.
And these same contract units have had their pay frozen, I think, now for the last 4 years. And nonetheless, that is far too generous for Commodore Perry. And I guess also when you're running a campaign that is losing to Alan Quist, any kind of free media you can get is a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I think we'll see a lot of Mike Perry fulminating.
It's good that we're talking about the Draz again. We haven't really been talking about him very much
Draz
at all. And, you know, you said his name and it brought back memories.
I know.
About the Draz.
I just saw Tony just perk up. You know, he heard the Draz. He's like, what? The Draz? Yeah, actually, Steve Drazkowski and Mike Perry are the co-chairs of the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, which is a rarely convened subcommittee, but only pretty much votes on these employee contracts. And in case you're not familiar with this stuff, basically, we're a whole year and a half behind. These contracts are about 17 months overdue, I think, at this point. Part of this has to do with a difficult financial situation, but also Frankly, I think everyone knew this is what was going to happen. No matter what contract you negotiated, you were going to have Mike Perry doing this. In fact, I think he came out and said that these contracts were negotiated in secret. Yeah, that's how contract negotiations usually work. This is the same. These are the same people that thought it was totally fine to close the Capitol to all everyone, including the press, while they negotiated a shutdown agreement. But now all of a sudden, you can't negotiate a contract in secret.
God forbid.
It's terrible. One last story that I thought really kind of popped out at me this week. There was a Daily Beast article describing the relationship between Michelle Bachmann's accusations about Islamic influence in the government and her source, a guy named Gaffney, who's actually, this is why we were talking about this last week, which is why in the world is this attracting attention now of Republicans? Because, you know, we've heard Crazy Michelle saying crazy stuff for a long time. But why was it this time that it actually came out with, you know, McCain speaking on the floor of the Senate? Well, it turns out that Frank Gaffney, Michelle Bachmann's foreign policy advisor, thinks that Grover Norquist's wife, who is a Muslim, is actually a kind of Rasputin figure trying to convert the conservative establishment of Washington, D.C. into a secret Muslim brotherhood society something or other. And also Karl Rove's involved in this, by the way, because he hangs out with Saudis. So therefore, he must also be in on the conspiracy. Anyway, so if you wanted to know why Michelle Bachmann's most recent accusations got the attention of Republicans, well, it's because they're going after Grover and Rover, and they're coming after... You can't do that without getting some attention. All right, that's the Weekly Wrap. You can find links and commentary on these stories on our website, left.mn. Just click on Weekly Wrap. Next, who has more money, more problems, and who has less money, more problems? You're listening to the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's brought to you by Left.MN, the Minnesota website that leans left. I'm Aaron Clems, and I'm with the spreadsheet master, Tony Petrangelo, who's been looking at the fundraising reports released this week by the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. You know, money's kind of a necessary evil in political campaigns. And actually, it's kind of interesting to look at these reports right now because there's only a month between when the last numbers were released to the federal government and then this month's state number release for the congressional campaigns, right?
Well, it's actually less because the deadline was July 25th, so 25 days.
So 25 days, and that means that Michelle Bachmann raised, what, $40,000 a day?
Yeah, I guess I didn't do the math.
Because 25 divided by millions, that's a lot. That's $40,000 a day.
Yeah, so that means you spent like $20,000 a day too.
Yeah, so if you're not following Michelle Bachmann, everyone's following Michelle Bachmann. We just got done talking with her, but all that foo-foo about the Islamic about her. That's right.
That would be quite the get.
We're not quite that big league.
Yeah,
yet.
No. She doesn't talk to real media.
Well, maybe we got a chance then.
Well, there you go.
So anyway, she has been actually benefiting fundraising-wise from this whole tempest in a teapot, I guess.
Yeah, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, and that's kind of the long-term plan for fundraising for Michelle Bachmann. But the way that she raises money is it costs a lot of money to raise money.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she spent $770,000 of that money while she raised a million. So, and it's not like she's running a really active campaign right now. That's mostly fundraising costs.
Yeah, she sends out, it's a lot of direct mail, a lot of raising money over the phone, calling people up to raise money, but not her. That she uses firms that, you know, like telemarketing firms for stuff like that. So,
yeah.
All those things are really expensive.
Yeah, and, you know, basically, think of it this way, you have to spend a dollar to raise a dollar.
She spends a dollar, raises two.
Okay,
well. Something like that.
Yeah, at least she stays above water that way. She also transferred some money around. She put some money back into her presidential campaign that had some debt. And she also started actually living up to her promise to max out contributions to every Republican legislative candidate through her Michelle PAC. She maxed out, I think, 28 of them with $500 donations each, and they came from two big donors, about $15,000. The rest of the congressional races are kind of falling into a pretty clear pattern. The incumbents are doing really well.
Yeah, incumbents tend to do that.
Yeah, well, you'd hope so. And there's a couple of them that are sitting back and grinning as they watch their primary, their opponents who are in a primary, tear each other apart, right? So down here in southern Minnesota, you got Tim Walz in the catbird seat, watching Alan Quist and Commodore Perry go after each other. So how's it going down there?
Well, as we talked about earlier, Perry's grandstanding because he can't raise any money for any other type of campaigning. Neither of them are raising any money. The only money any of them are raising are from themselves, and that's Alan Quist giving himself money.
And he's done a lot of that.
He's done a lot of that, yeah. Yeah, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he's not loaning it to himself. Well, some of it is. This period, he loaned himself $10,000, but a lot of it he just gave himself.
Must be nice.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's what happens when you're successful. And that's actually the line that he's using amongst Republicans, talking about how if Mike Perry were a more successful businessman, he'd be doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. If he believed in his campaign, he'd fund his campaign to the level that Alan Quist is.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's pretty compelling logic. I don't know why Mike Perry doesn't feel confident enough in his Godfather's franchise to bankroll himself $200,000 or something like that. In any case, whoever emerges...
Maybe Herman Cain's not returning his calls.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Maybe the National Restaurant Association needs a new lobbyist or something. Because at the end of this, I don't think there's much risk of Tim Walz going down, although... You know, you always got to take it seriously, but Tim Walz has done everything he can, and he's got a very weakened opponent no matter who emerges from that. On the DFL side, we have something, hopefully it doesn't end up being similar to that. At least it hasn't been that nasty. But now money is starting to get spent in earnest up there in CD8.
Yeah, Terrell Clark reported spending $225,000 in the last 25 days.
And that's amazing because it doesn't cost that much to buy television ads in the Duluth Superior market. I mean, it's not free or anything like that, but it's nothing compared to buying ad time down here in the Twin Cities market.
No, so that – and then, well, when Aaron Brown was on last week, he had said that the ads were just wall-to-wall.
Yeah.
So
– and she's got the – but she has the cash to burn through. The problem is that she at this rate that she's spending, if she survives the primary, she won't have much left over.
No.
Then again, of course, it's this is going to be one of the primary target seats for the for the national organizations, and so it's pretty safe to say whoever emerges from this primary will probably be able to raise plenty of money in a relatively short period of time to run an effective campaign.
Well, you would hope so. The problem is Kravac's already sitting on almost a mil.
Yep, and he has done everything he can to get ready for a race, and it's going to be up to the DFLer who emerges to really get themselves in order quick in order to take him on.
There's really not much in the congressional level. I mean, the 7th is what you would expect. 4th and 5th are what you would expect.
Yeah, well, we saw a spike in Keith Ellison's fundraising this month.
Yes.
Apparently, he's the one who's benefiting from the attention that Michelle Bachmann is garnering and not her opponent, Jim Graves.
Well, because his name is the one that's in the media reports about it because he's the one she's attacking.
Yeah, and he's the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, too. Or as Alan West calls it, a bunch of communists. So there's also many of the numbers that came out were also legislative numbers. And so this is really our first glimpse at a lot of the donation patterns for some races that have been kind of in the dark so far because you don't pull a lot of these legislative races. So what did we learn?
It's not a surprise that the legislative seat that's garnering the most money is in Edina.
Yeah, over $100,000 raised in the SD49 race between Melissa Franson and Keith Downey.
Yeah, and that race always attracts a lot of, at least the last few cycles it has.
Well, I mean, Keith Downey is the friend of every corporate consultant on the planet, so it's not surprising that he's getting a lot of money. But Melissa Franson's fundraising acumen has proven to be pretty substantial.
She raised the most of any non-incumbent legislative candidate.
No, and she needed to keep up with Keith Downey.
Yeah, because he's raking it in, too.
On one side of that district, too, you've got a House race that's gotten a lot of money, too, between Bill Glahn and Ron Earhart. Bill Glahn was Tim Pawlenty.
Another consultant.
Yeah, he's another consultant. In fact, Bill Glahn's primary job or his most recent public service job was energy advisor to Tim Pawlenty. This is, of course, after Tim Pawlenty did reasonable things with energy, like the renewable portfolio standard. And he believes that there's a war on coal. There'll be more about this on Left.MN this week, I swear.
Well, but didn't he join the Pawlenty campaign or the Pawlenty administration after Pawlenty had begun to backtrack on a lot of that?
Yeah, he was like the guy that they went to reestablish
his conservative credentials.
And so he's running against Ron Earhart, and Ron Earhart has been... Well, Ron Earhart's been around for a while. He's running two different parties and a third and as an independent as well. He's running as a DFLer this time, and he's raised, I think, over $20,000 in his race.
Yeah, and then, you know, Senate District 5 has seen a ton of money raised, and there's no surprise there because there's six incumbents running for those three seats.
Yeah, so everyone's tapping into their fundraising networks. And it's, you know, I think both parties rightfully see Senate District 5 as one of the places where control of both houses of the legislature will be determined. Then you've got independent groups as well that are also raising money, especially on the Republican side. This is worth watching because the Republican Party is in big trouble. So Minnesota's Future raised $475,000 from some of the same characters who funded Minnesota Forward last time. You know, and they're going to have to do more of that because the Republican Party is not going to be able to help. All right, when we come back, we're talking to Dr. Maureen Hackett, founder of Howling for Wolves, howlingforwolves.org, and she'll talk to us about why a wolf hunt's a bad idea and how we can stop it.
I'm a howling wolf. I've been howling all around your door.
Welcome back. This is the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, brought to you by Left.MN, the Minnesota website that leans left. After decades of protection under the Endangered Species Act, the wolf faces a new wave of hunting and trapping seasons across the United States. First in Idaho and Montana, now in Minnesota and Wisconsin, state governments are planning to allow hunting of wolves. And we're joined today by Dr. Maureen Hackett. She's the founder of Howling for Wolves, a Minnesota group opposed to wolf hunting. And this week, Howling for Wolves has made a last-ditch push to get the DNR to reconsider their plans to hold a wolf hunting and trapping season in Minnesota this fall, including a number of billboards popping up in the Twin Cities area. Dr. Hackett, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. So what inspired you to found Howling for Wolves?
I think what really got to me was the entire process of how we were going about approving and putting into law a wolf hunt. It all started last summer when, under basically behind closed doors, while the emergency session was pretty much put in after the government shutdown, we had four lines of a 101-page budget bill that said, hey, you can hunt the wolf or have a proposed a hunting season, Mr. DNR, once the wolf is delisted. At that point, the wolf hadn't even been delisted. At that point, the public wasn't even aware that it might be delisted. And our government, the DNR, and when they petitioned to have the wolf delisted, said they had a wolf management plan. And the wolf management plan said no sooner than 5 years will a wolf hunt be proposed.
And that wolf management plan is the thing that was filed with the federal government as part of the delisting process. Is that right?
I believe they filed it. They certainly mentioned it and put it as part of the delisting. I'm assuming they attached it. And as part of that wolf management plan, if the DNR were to propose a wolf hunt, which was not to occur any sooner than 5 years after the delisting, meaning we kind of put it in the short lingo of a moratorium on hunting for 5 years, they were supposed to get public comment, full public comment, and accurate scientific data, including population surveys, before this type of thing would be approved. And I think what got to me was the process. Mm-hmm. So then, during the legislative session, I caught wind that there was a committee hearing on the wolf hunt. And so I went, and I saw pretty much inside baseball going on, and they had decided, even without taking testimony from many people, in my opinion, because I had asked to testify and filed a regular old request, that they were just, this was a done deal. And that's why I did this. I felt that the public needed to know. I thought the people of Minnesota value wolves. I think the people of Minnesota benefit from live wolves. The International Wolf Center is revered worldwide. It brings in tourists internationally, and we could bring in a lot more. We also have an ecosystem that is uniquely in need of wolves. After I learned so much about the wolves in Yellowstone and what wolves do for habitat, I realized our water is really dependent on our wolves, too, as is our even our deer population.
Yeah, so why the rush? I mean, why are they rushing so quickly to get this season in place? I think it was January, the delisting from the Endangered Species Act happens, and by April, they're already passing legislation to try to.
Right. The delisting actually, I think the federal approval for the delisting actually occurred in late December, probably December 27th or so, maybe the 22nd, and it officially went into action it must have been January 27th, so it must have been December 27th, 30 days later. And the rush to hunt is a good question. We did obtain internal documents, which is why we came out with our press release on Monday. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you're aware of some of the documents. We've only released a few statements, but I kind of give you a little bit of an insider look at it. They pretty much were trying to decide how do we get this through as fast as possible in December of 2011 before the delisting even occurred.
And this is the DNR or the?
This is the DNR, and they were talking in these documents about an emergency expedited or expedited emergency rule. Pretty sure it's expedited emergency rule, and how that could be used to establish the rules of a wolf hunt. Mm. And why the emergency and why? Why do that? And I think we both know the answer.
So the online survey that the DNR did about the wolf hunt is their idea of public input into this process.
Well, it was pretty clear to me that what they were that was part of it, but that's not full public comment. That's not the spirit of full public comment. Full public comment requires open hearings or open meetings where people can discuss with one another why they are or are not in favor of a wolf hunt, where they can respond to other people's comments. And that's not what happened. And I think what the reason for the expedited rulemaking process was, we're going to get this through. No matter what, we're going to get this through.
Mm. So just to bring folks up to speed, there was a survey that was done by the DNR. And the survey was done online. And at the end of the process, they said, okay, yeah, 80% of the folks who responded or so said, we don't want a wolf hunt. And so the DNR put out the results in two different documents, one for the people who were supporters of the season and one for folks who weren't. And they said, we're going to just disregard the 79% of folks that we don't like the idea of a wolf hunting and trapping season. And we're listening just to the 21% that said that they did.
Exactly. And what they based that on was they said, well, this wasn't really about whether we were going to have a hunt or not. This was about establishing the rules of the hunt. This was about the details of the hunt. And so in reality, if you think about it, there was no public comment deciding whether we would or would not have a wolf trapping and shooting season.
You're listening to the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We're talking to Dr. Maureen Hackett about potentially a wolf hunt here in Minnesota. So your group is pushing really hard to try to get the DNR to reconsider their decision.
We're pushing both the DNR Commissioner Landwehr and the governor to reconsider having a wolf hunting season. Trapping and shooting is what we call it. Because it really is shooting wolves while they're running from, you know, between deer hunters and stands on opening day of deer hunting season. And we're basically going to push enough to let them know that the public is going to know what this internal process was like. Hmm. And when the public knows, my concern, I'm hoping and I think that the governor will be concerned that they will see they didn't count. The public, the 79% who opposed didn't matter.
Yeah, and that's not just a number of percentage. This is, I think, what, 5,800 comments, I think, that were against the idea of a wolf hunt. Something
yes,
like that.
It was. And what's very interesting in all of this is many of those comments were from hunters, but they want to say that they were not from hunters. Many people who are hunters of deer and, consumption hunting are against wolf hunt because they view it as really unfair to trap and bait a wolf. They're going to bait them even for shooting them. So many people that
feel... So like bears? You can actually like put out a bait pile and wait for a wolf to come by and then shoot it.
Yes.
That's not exactly very sporting.
That's why we're trying not to even use the word hunt, because it really is shooting and trapping wolves. But, so we want people to know about this. We want people to pressure the government. It really is up to them. It's a permissive rule. It says they may have a wolf hunt. Doesn't say they must. The legislators that passed it were under an incredible amount of pressure because Governor Dayton did want and probably needed a game and fish bill in order to increase license fees,
mm-hmm.
which is the whole paradigm of the entire DNR, which is they get money off of licenses. So, but we're different in Minnesota. We have a legacy fund, too, and we have a lottery.
Right. So now there's – I think they're planning on selling, 6,000
yes.
Permits? And they're going to charge, I think, something in the realm of
$26.
$26. That's a pretty major revenue source for the
Well, DNR. Not – yes, but it's not renewable in my opinion. You know, it's – they're looking at making money off of this hunting season, But what their revenue season, actually, they're going to get revenue off of 50 cents of every fishing and game hunting license. Every license they'll get 50 cents from for wolf livestock conflict results, you know, depredation, mm-hmm. they call that. So there is another way that they will be getting money. But I say we can make a lot more money off the wolf alive, and it would be more sustainable, and it would be year-round than right. to kill them.
So now the trapping, there's two parts of the season. The first part is this that they proposed is the early season, which is going to be coinciding with the firearms deer season.
Yes.
And a second part of the season, which they call the late season, that will be partially trapping and partially another hunting season that goes through, I think, early January.
It will be almost all trapping, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be really hard to do hunting or shooting, I should say, with that much snow on the ground, especially where they're going to be doing it. So the thing I found fascinating about reading the survey results was that there was a lot of debate amongst folks who actually support the season about whether or not they like the idea of a trapping season or not. And so you got trappers on the one hand saying the wolves that will get shot during the early season are not in, you know, they're going to be in their fall coats. They're not going to be a desirable pelt. I mean, assuming that's valuable at all. And then you've got folks who are the early season hunter advocates saying, well, you know, it's just barbaric to trap wolves.
Yes.
And I just think that's really fascinating to listen to this kind of internecine debate between these two groups.
And what's really sad is this is the time when wolves are pairing off and deciding who's going to be the alpha and who's going to have the pups, and then they mate in February. So while they say it's not when they're having pups and not reproducing, this is kind of preliminary to it, and under stress they may not even, you know, go into a reproductive period.
So you mentioned earlier about how the DNR should have been doing more comprehensive population surveys.
Yes.
And so the documents that I've read say that the DNR believes there's about 3,000 or so wolves in Minnesota.
As of 2008 estimates, okay. And we can talk about how they did that.
So do you think that number is too high, or is it?
I think when I looked at how they estimate wolves, which is on our website under Wolf Analysis Survey Population, there's a document under Resources, and it's done by the DNR in 2008. And it's well done, and it says, you know, for cost purposes, they needed to estimate the wolves by having a mail-in survey over a six-month period of time from November through April, which we won't have. We're not going to get that before we do the shooting and the trapping. And they looked at track reports, foot tracks, mm-hmm. scat or poop reports, howling and deer carcass reports, and visuals. And only 16% of all that data was actually visualizing a wolf. The rest was tracks, poop, and maybe howls and a deer carcass. Mm-hmm. And we all know the deer carcass could come from another animal. We all know that tracks could be, maybe misinterpreted as multiple wolves, and it might be the same couple of wolves coming back.
Right.
I mean, I'm not an expert. I have to be careful not to. But I think it's quite possible that, in general, it shows a stable population, but at the actual numbers could actually be consistently overinflated every time.
Mm-hmm.
03, 08, 98. Of course, they're not going to want to hear that, but they actually admit in their survey that it's very difficult to estimate wolves. It's very expensive to collar them. And I thought this was reasonable if you weren't going to base a hunt on them.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I you sent me that document, I took a look at it, and it basically says that it's a plus or minus 650 within a 90% margin of confidence. And so basically it's somewhere between 2,350 and 3,600, and there's still a 10% chance we might be wrong about that. And that's kind of that's how much of an answer they can give right now.
Right. So I think logic would tell you that without seeing the wolf, without having a collared pack, that we don't really know exactly how many wolves we have. And the reality is let's stop the count, kill, charade.
Okay. And we'll talk more about that when we come right back with Dr. Maureen Hackett from Howling for Wolves. You're listening to the AM 950, Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950.